from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made this past Thursday night in the pages of one of the country's most well-known conservative publications, the National Review. This is a magazine that, in the 1950s and 60s, famously attempted to expel John Birchers and anti-Semites from the conservative movement. And now, as the Atlantic Monthly notes, the magazine is attempting to do the same with Donald Trump, an entire edition devoted to taking Trump down with commentary from more than a dozen right-wing leaders. Trump, they warn, must not be allowed to win this nomination. Where was this commentary 5 months ago? Well, to be fair, most pundits, probably many voters, thought Trump was not going to last. He would get bored, say something stupid, go back to his business world. Turns out that no matter how many stupid things he says, he is here to stay in this race. He could very well win it. This hour, we're surveying the Republican landscape as we head toward Iowa, New Hampshire, and beyond. We want to hear from you. What issues animate you and the GOP electorate in the primary season? And our guests this hour are going to help explain some of that. In fact, I've got a couple of guests from the University of Rochester College Republicans who will help us understand why they're supporting, who they're supporting, and what's animating some younger voters. Anna Garvey and Josh Veronica are here. Anna is a chemical engineering major from the Buffalo area. Nice to have you here, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
Also here, Josh Veronica. He is a political science and business major, and again, with the University of Rochester College Republicans. Nice to see you, Josh.
Great to be here.
And also here is Tim Nealon, the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. And the last time we talked about Republicans in this presidential race in July, Tim, it was a very different field. So a lot has changed.
Yeah, Jeb who?
Well, I mean, he's still running.
I believe so.
He wants you to believe that he is going to be the one once Trump and Cruz knock each other out. Jeb wants you to believe. Or are we supposed to say Jeb is going to knock him out?
That must be it. Yeah,
not going to happen for Jeb.
It's like that story, millions of cats, you know, and then at the end there's only one cat left. I don't think Jeb's going to be that cat. Sorry, guys.
All right. Well, our University of Rochester College Republicans are both supporting Anna
Marco Rubio.
Okay, and why?
We really feel, I think a lot of us at U of R and in the College Republicans, that he is the most electable candidate, the one with the strongest grasp of foreign policy, and will have the best general election appeal. As far as an establishment candidate, we tend to go for the one who's the most conservative that we think can get elected in the general, and I think he has the best chance.
All right, so you both like him, but you also think pragmatically this is a guy who can win.
I really do.
Okay. Josh, what do you think?
That's absolutely right. If you look at his life story, he's the son of immigrants. He grew up as a minority. He had student debt, just like we're going to have. I think he's a very relatable candidate to so many young Americans and Americans as a whole.
Okay. Now, Tim Nealon, can Marco Rubio still... it was interesting. I would say 2 months ago, I thought he was going to be the nominee. I thought there was a coalescing. Some big money donors were sort of switching over to Rubio. There was a lot of talk that this was a guy, given his background that Anna and Josh just talked about, could win a national election. But I don't see what state he's going to win early on. And then the question becomes, does it dry up for him?
Okay, so before March 15th, all of the states are allocating their delegates based upon your primary showing or your caucus showing. So he doesn't have to win a state. He's just got to stay in it long enough for the attrition to kick in for some of these other candidates and then to pick up some of those would-be voters. I mean, in the long run, I mean, Marco Rubio is quite electable. He does have the establishment candidate credentials. He can appeal to evangelicals, who are about 20% or more of the party. And in the long run, about 30 to 40% of Republicans nationwide are not even that conservative. And a guy like Rubio, because he's not Ted Cruz, might appeal to that particular allocation of delegates too. So I think he does have a path to win, but he's just got to survive long enough. The Des Moines Register just helped him by coming out and saying that he would be their Republican pick. So that's going to give him some life in Iowa. And Joni Ernst came out and supported him. Now, she hasn't endorsed anyone, but neither has Charles Grassley, who came out and sort of stood with Trump. So I think Rubio is certainly someone that is still in the hunt.
Okay. I actually think he'd have a very good chance to win a national election, maybe more so than any candidate in the field. And one of the reasons is, I just read a very interesting, I think it was Evan Osnos in The New Yorker, wrote a long piece on Marco Rubio that talked about where Rubio has gone on some of the issues. Immigration, not the least of them. He's taken some hits for his part of the Gang of Eight in this primary season. Interestingly enough, you look at the demographics, Republicans I don't think can win without a decent showing in the Latino vote, because of the shifting demographics. And Marco Rubio, with his background, could win some of that, even though some people view him as sort of an apostate because of his work with the Gang of Eight. The New Yorker piece basically said he's counting internally that some Latinos will say, okay, I didn't like that, but I'm not going to turn my back on a conservative Latino. I will vote for him. And is that part of the equation, you think?
I think people will be able to get over the whole deal with the Gang of Eight. I think until, like you said, people in the establishment lane start to sort of go to the wayside, it'll be harder. But I think as far as immigration goes, that will be something he'll be able to get over in the general.
Well, you guys are college students. You have a senior and a sophomore, very engaged politically. But is that an issue that motivates you? Or what are the issues that are top of mind? Anna, does immigration matter to you?
It does, but I would say that I tend to be a little bit more moderate on that particular issue personally, so maybe I'm a little skewed as far as that goes. But I think as far as conservative issues that matter the most, I think national security is really the first, followed by economic freedom, and those are issues that he is really strong on that would sort of tip the scale in his favor as far as people getting over the immigration issue.
Josh, what are the issues that matter to you most?
I would say national security first and foremost. I mean, we've grown up seeing 9/11, the rise of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and now the Islamic State. So we've really never been alive when, you know, foreign policy has not been a huge issue in the news. So that's something that young people especially really care about, because it's constantly affected us since the day we've been born. So we really like to see some more stability in the Middle East, just some strong foreign policy as a whole. Also on top of that is college affordability. I would say that that's an issue that really hurts a lot of young people, takes away a lot of opportunities for us to rise economically. That's something Senator Rubio has laid out plenty of plans for making college more affordable and making it easier for students to pay back the student loans.
You want a president who's had loan debt himself, don't you, Jeff?
Absolutely. Marco Rubio had over $100,000 in student loan debt until just a few years ago, so he understands that struggle firsthand.
He would definitely understand it firsthand. What on the foreign policy side makes you think he's got the experience to understand that?
Well, first of all, he just understands it better than anyone else in the race, I believe. I mean, if you look at the strategies he's laid out for, you know, helping to arm the Kurds to defeat the Islamic State, and everything he's proposed has been a rock-solid plan that I think America can get behind.
Okay. Tim Nealon, so it sounds like this is the argument for Marco Rubio if he gets there. And you're saying he doesn't have to win Iowa. He's not going to win Iowa. He's probably not going to win New Hampshire.
Nope.
And that's okay.
No. In the past, you just had to come into the top three. That, and then from 1980 till 2012, we could count on South Carolina as being a sort of marker of who is going to go on to get the nomination. We can't do that anymore because Newt Gingrich won that in 2012. But we can still look at that. And then from there, what we want to do is we just want to see, you know, what happens when people start dropping out. And they can't sustain it much longer. I mean, we're going to have a lot of hoopla this coming couple of weeks. And then after that, things are going to settle down a little bit. He's got to survive, and he could go on. Now, his problem is that because he is still sort of in the top tier, he's taking a lot of hits from Trump and from Cruz. I mean, they're really going negative on him. It doesn't help that Jeb Bush is sniping at him. I mean, Jeb is, you know, was his mentor. They were very close in Florida. Florida's going to be a key state no matter what happens, whoever gets the nomination. And you certainly want to have Republicans on the same team. And it's okay to snipe it. I mean, George H., you know, W. Bush and Reagan didn't get along very well, but then they ended up working together. But sooner rather than later, because Rubio is so far behind when you look at some of the points totals.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of Marco Rubio's comments. This is Senator Marco Rubio talking about next steps. He's talking about tax code, regulatory system. He's talking about Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, and more. Marco Rubio.
The first thing we need to do is we need to even out the tax code for small businesses so that we lower their tax rate to 25%, just as we need to lower it for all businesses. We need to have a regulatory budget in America that limits the amount of regulations on our economy. We need to repeal and replace Obamacare, and we need to improve higher education so that people can have access to the skills they need for 21st century jobs. And last but not least, we need to repeal Dodd-Frank. It is eviscerating small businesses and small banks. Over 40% of small and mid-sized banks that loan money to small businesses have been wiped out since Dodd-Frank has passed. We need to repeal and replace Dodd-Frank. We need to make America fair again for all businesses, but especially those being run by small business owners.
All right, so I'm sure Anna and Josh are kind of nodding along, saying, you know, that's the kind of thing they want to hear. So they're Rubio supporters. Last hour, we had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders supporters. Oddly, no O'Malley supporters. You know, who knows? Maybe there's an O'Malley surge. Who knows? But we asked our panelists last hour, if the candidate you're supporting in the primaries does not win, will you support the nominee? Because there are a lot more Republicans in the field, viable Republicans, let me just ask you this. Anna, is there any Republican possible nominee that you would not vote for?
I would not vote for Donald Trump. I would, absolutely would not.
Would you simply not vote, or would you vote for Hillary Clinton? Would you vote for Bernie Sanders?
I don't think I could vote for Bernie Sanders.
Would you vote for a Libertarian candidate,
Gary
Johnson?
I probably would end up voting third party Libertarian or just simply not voting at all. And I don't think I'm alone in that as far as other Republicans that I know that just could not see themselves getting behind Donald Trump. We just find him to be hateful and not has no respect for the Constitution. You know, a true conservative wouldn't really be able to get behind Donald Trump. So other than that, I think I could see myself supporting most of them out in the field, but definitely not Trump.
Josh, Veronica, is there any candidate?
Just Donald Trump. I think everyone else in the Republican field would be a good candidate. Obviously, I think Marco Rubio is the best, but, you know, even John Kasich, Jeb Bush, I think they'd all be great presidents. But Donald Trump is the one where I would really be afraid for our national security if he was the president.
So what's going on then, guys? What's going on right now?
I think there's a combination of a lot of things that has just been sort of a tragedy of all of these different things going on that have led, I think people, first of all, like what they have not had before. So I feel like Donald Trump is the absolute antithesis of President Obama, and that has contributed to some of his popularity. Other than that, I think the fact that the field is just so crowded this year has made it hard for there to be a foil on the Republican side. Like we were talking about, once Marco Rubio hangs in there for a while, or any candidate, the establishment lane needs to come down to one so that we have a clear alternative, because at this point, it's been just too many voices in the room to be able for most people to just narrow down to one, except for this one person who's just so large in the room.
Okay. Josh, what do you think?
That's absolutely right. I think there's no one else in the race that has a personality quite like Donald Trump. I think that's why Jeb Bush has not been successful and Scott Walker dropped out already. It's because they seem too plain in comparison to Trump. So I think Trump's been very successful in just identifying the fears and the anger of Americans in terms of politics. And he's been just very successful in talking about that, playing on those fears, and that's reflected in his poll numbers.
In putting this panel together today, we were looking for Rochester for Trump, Monroe County for Trump, you know, Finger Lakes for Trump. And I know there are Trump supporters out there. In fact, if you're one of them, if you're listening right now, call the program. I want to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. A lot of people who would have liked to join the panel today were simply not available. And part of what we're doing today is helping out NPR on the national level. They've asked the member stations around the country, especially those who have talk shows, hey, reach out, you know, spend a day this week where you're talking to voters about the upcoming primaries. What are the issues that are animating them, motivating them, et cetera? And it wasn't hard to find Clinton Sanders supporters, then a lot harder to find Trump supporters. So Anna, you were saying you recently got an email about maybe canvassing for Trump.
Yeah, I've definitely have come across some Trump supporters, and it surprises me to see them in actual positions of, you know, political know-how. But to be honest, I can't say I know very many Trump supporters.
As much as you may debate other supporters of different Republicans, is it harder for you to feel like you're talking in good faith to Trump supporters? Does it frustrate you?
Yeah, I would say so. You try not to get frustrated with people, because I think open and honest debate is really like a centerpiece of our political scene, but it is hard to have a rational discussion just because the reaction to him is so extreme one way or the other. I think the supporters of Trump are so vehemently in support of him, it's hard to convince them otherwise, no matter what you say. And I don't think, honestly, someone talking to me about why they feel Donald Trump should be president would be able to sway me either way. So it's that kind of conversation that's definitely hard to have.
Josh?
That's correct. I mean, you talk to, you know, Rubio supporters or Bush supporters, and they talk about policy. They talk about economics and foreign policy, things along those lines. Bernie Sanders supporters, they talk about the minimum wage and college and things like that. You talk to Trump supporters, and it's 100% about his personality. They say, you know, he's not going to back down to anybody.
He's going to get it done.
And that seems to be the main issue for Trump supporters, which makes it very difficult to debate them on that.
You know what he's going to get done? It.
Yeah, it. But even if you listen to him in the debates, they say, okay, how are you going to do it? You watch. That's what he says. You know, you watch. watch and see how I'm going to do it. And I just can't see how a serious person would be drawn to that. But it, apparently somebody is, because his poll numbers are so high, although I think those are misleading too.
Yeah, I would say that. And remember, Trump has some very, very smart people. That's his famous line. He never tells us who any of these people are.
He
gets so overgeneralized and diffuse. He never names anyone who supports his plans. It's always very, very smart people have looked at this and told me, like, all these people apparently come to him privately. I would say that if you want to find Trump supporters, go on Facebook, because your demographic is not being attracted to Trump. It's that particularly male, white, frustrated, working class American, many of whom are independents. And that's what helps him in Iowa. You can show up at 6:30 or 6 o'clock next week, and then you can basically register to take part in the Iowa caucus, and you can decide what party you're going to be in. I think there's a lot of independents who are going to come and be Republican, and half of his support in Iowa are first time. That is people who've never taken part in the Iowa caucus before, and so I don't even know if they're going to show up. So that's why I would be a little cautious about any of these polls putting him so far ahead.
All right, let me get a phone call from someone who may be. John in Rochester. John, are you a Trump supporter?
Well, you know, the Republicans have, in a way I am, but the Republicans have, I think, unbelievable choices. I'm a Ted Cruz guy. I like Rubio a lot. I like Rick Santorum. I like Kasich.
Hold on. Rick Santorum is running again? Get out of here. I haven't seen him.
But I got to tell you, if Trump gets the nomination, I'm going with Trump. And I like a lot about what Trump says. And I think he's getting better at being a politician. But I think Trump has an outstanding chance to, number one, get the nomination, and number one, get the general election, because I think what your panel is missing here is I think he's going to get a lot of crossover votes from the Democrats. Blue-collar Democrats that Reagan got, and I think Trump would win New York in the general election, the first Republican since Reagan.
Upstate
New York is going to go big for Trump, I believe.
But John, hold on. So let me ask you a couple questions, because now we've got the mind of a Trump voter on for analysis here. So Anna is saying she's not hearing anything substantive. She said she talks to friends about Rubio, Cruz, Christie, Kasich, and it's policy discussion. And there are shades of differences. They hash it out. They talk. They try to convince each other. You talk to Trump people, and it's strength. He's going to get it done. He's going to bring the best negotiator. What specifically, John, are you hearing that you understand Trump would do? Explain this to me.
Well, Trump is going to, I think, take the posture of, and I have heard him say this, he's going to take the posture of what Reagan did. He unleashed the economy. Reduce taxes, reduce government spending. And Reagan was the most successful president, in my opinion. In fact, I was a Democrat. I voted for Jimmy Carter twice. And Reagan, after a couple of years of watching Reagan, I polished off my economics books from the University of Buffalo and saw that Milt Friedman and Art Laffer were right. It's not Keynesian economics at work. That's why our economy is in its slowest recovery in its history after a recession, is the economics, not Keynesian economics, but a supply-side economics that Milt Friedman is in favor of, and Donald Trump is too. Donald Trump has said he's going to unleash the economy similar to what Reagan did, and I assume he will take the policies of supply-side economics that Milt Friedman and Laffer had.
Okay, so supply-side economics. Josh, no?
I don't understand.
Stay there, John. Stay there. Go ahead, Josh.
I don't understand what unleashing the economy means, and I think that's the
cutting taxes.
Right, and that's great to say, and it sounds good in a speech to compare yourself to Reagan, but I think that's the biggest problem with these people who are not career politicians, is that they don't have any experience in doing that. That's the problem with Ben Carson and Trump and Fiorina.
And by the way, John, if you cut taxes to the level that Donald Trump has said in this campaign, and you increase military spending, you are going to increase the deficit. And I understand that you love, trickle down, supply side, but just about every serious study says you also have to cut spending.
You have
to cut spending as well.
No, Evan, you got to reverse. Trickle down.
You don't have to cut spending
right now. Trickle down is Keynesian economics, where the government picks winners and losers. Supply-side economics is the opposite. Supply-side economics, the resources are taken out of the hands of government, put it in the hands of entrepreneurs.
No, I understand that.
And small business, and that's where the trickle up happens. This is why our economy is in a bad situation. It's the slowest growth from a recession we've ever had in our history. So as far as Reagan goes and Trump, if you have tax cuts, that's going to stimulate the economy and generate a lot of new business, which will produce more taxes. Where Reagan was, he failed to a certain extent. He wasn't able to convince Tip O'Neill and even some Republicans to decrease government spending. Reagan was going to eliminate the Department of Energy, tone down the Department of Education. And if this is what, if he was able to do that, we would have still been going strong from that surge. And I think Trump has that same philosophy. He's decreased government spending in areas that are duplicating what we have in the States.
Well,
Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, Department of Education. That's the key right there.
Now, John, a part of our guests and our Republican guests here, Anna and Josh, are talking about pragmatism as well. They like Marco Rubio in many ways, but they also are looking to who can win. Donald Trump is not going to come close to getting the Latino vote necessary to win. He has a lot of old white supporters. He does not have a diverse coalition, and this country is getting less white. Mitt Romney, who was a governor, who had some ways to appeal to people across the aisle, who's very likable, who looks like a president, whatever that means. He did not win enough of the Latino vote to win. And Donald Trump has inflamed the non-white vote in this country.
I disagree with you on that. I think Trump has gotten support from legal Hispanic immigrants.
Yeah.
Legal. And those are the people that I think he will do well with. And I think he's going to get a lot of the urban vote, too. Because of he's well liked. He's going to get a lot of crossover Democrats.
Okay, thank you, John. Tim Nealon, you want to jump in?
I would just say, you know, we've had, you know, the Carl Palladino races. We've had the angry, you know, voice that Donald Trump gives across New York State, and you know, a lot of Republicans stayed home. I just think you're confusing hyper-conservative Republicans who listen to Rush Limbaugh with many, many people in that party, maybe over a third, who are a little more moderate. And they're not moderate, and they're not liberal, but they're not as conservative. And I think those people are going to not vote for Donald Trump come the New York State primary. And I don't think that Democrats will carry New York again in the fall. So you really got to get Latino voters. You got to get people who are independents. You've got to convince them that you have a policy that they can support. And I'm not sure that the Trump has done that. He makes a lot of noise. He's great theater. But pragmatism is one of the things Republicans are really good at, and they try to find, they don't want to fall, you know, in love, they want to fall in line, and I'm not sure that Donald Trump is the one that they're going to line up.
Anna?
I would also say that Trump tends to have the highest unfavorable ratings among people that they're polling, whereas, like, if you look at most of the other candidates, people might be sort of indifferent, but people just have this vitriolic reaction to Trump, which I think will hurt him if he were to go to the general, which I don't think he will. But also, as far as polling him versus Hillary Clinton, he's the one that has consistently lost. So I think that's a danger that people should be aware of voting for him in the primaries, that he, of all of them, is the one that's consistently losing to Hillary Clinton, who I do think will end up taking the Dems nomination pretty easily.
Look, though, I've been wrong. I've been saying since July, this is a flash in the pan. This is good for brand building. And it turned out that Ben Carson was the guy trying to sell books, and Donald Trump is trying to become president, and he may win the nomination. Let me get Bill in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Bill. Bill, go ahead.
I had a question because I think it's the most serious threat to both Republicans and Democrats. But since we're talking about the Republicans, I think Michael Bloomberg is a very, very serious threat against Mark Rubio, because I think the left wing of the Republican Party and the right wing of the Democratic Party are so numerous that he could easily pick a lot of votes from those areas. And I was just wondering, in terms of the Republican nomination, I think Bloomberg is a serious threat.
Bill, thanks for the phone call. I suspect he'd be run as an independent.
No, he'd run as an independent, not as a Republican.
He'd run as an independent if he felt like it was going to be Trump or maybe Cruz, someone who looked less electable, right, along with maybe Sanders, or if I don't know how what his relationship is like with Secretary Clinton. But what do you make of Michael Bloomberg? Anna, Josh?
Well, yeah, it was my understanding that he was only considering getting in the race if it came down to be Trump Sanders or Cruz Sanders, and then maybe he could, like, pull together the middle. But
I think he'd have a very good shot in that kind of a race.
Yeah, possibly. I think it'll be unlikely that it actually happens, but who knows?
it really does depend who gets the nomination from each of the parties, but I think any time you have a third-party candidate, it's really dangerous. I mean, the classic example is 1912 with Taft, Roosevelt, and Wilson. You know, Taft and Roosevelt split those votes and Wilson won easily. That happens all the time. Even in Erie County, those elections happen all the time. So anytime you get a third-party candidate, that is dangerous. If Bloomberg does run, I'd be interested to see then if there's maybe a fourth-party candidate, maybe if Trump or Sanders decides to go independent and things like
great.
That.
It's going to really keep getting crazier.
I can't wait. Congress will get to decide this election. That'll be really good. And then they'll throw it to the
they're
Supreme
so good
Court.
At things,
and yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
We haven't talked much about Ted Cruz, who may be right now the most likely candidate. I don't know who is the single most likely candidate as we speak here, and I've learned not to talk about that. You know, I've made a lot of mistakes prognosticating here, but based on some of the early polls, it may be Ted Cruz. Let's get a short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear what Ted Cruz is saying about his opponents, what they're saying about him, and what our panel thinks about Ted Cruz as a possible nominee as well. That's next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, New Yorkers Against Gun Violence is sponsoring a one-time-only showing of the documentary No Control about guns in the United States. It's playing at the Little Theater Tuesday night. We will discuss the themes in the film in the first hour. Then second hour, ballet aimed at children with autism. We'll talk about that, all of that and more Tuesday on Connections.
How do you help a kid growing up in one of Chicago's most violent neighborhoods? Maybe by connecting him with someone who's lived through violence, someone like a military veteran.
Kids identify themselves as soldiers because they live in war zone communities.
Veterans and teenagers talk about trauma later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us this Monday afternoon. My guests, Anna Garvey and Josh Veronica, are young Republicans. I say young. They're with University of Rochester College Republicans, talking about not only their support for Marco Rubio, but their survey of the Republican field as we head towards the actual votes at long last, starting 1 week from today. Tim Nealon's the chair of Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College, also helping us take a look at the field. If you want to weigh in on the Republican side of the race, please do so. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. Toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Had a couple of emails in the last 5 minutes about Michael Bloomberg, and one of our emailers, Richard, wanted to know, could your Republican voters weigh in on, would they vote for him? So I assume you'd vote for Michael Bloomberg over Donald Trump, because you said you wouldn't support Trump. Yes?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say, probably Bloomberg over Trump, but I don't actually know very much about Bloomberg and his policies, so it's a little bit hard for me to say.
Okay. I don't think Republicans would because of the nanny state. I mean, he's the guy that imposed, you know, trying to take
limits on the size
of soda and taking salt. I mean, look, he's just too much of of everything Republicans actually oppose. Mm-hmm. I think if once Republicans looked at him, they'd be like, what? He's a Democrat, or I guess a moderate Republican from the 1950s, but he does not fit the scheme of contemporary Republican values.
Okay, well, would you consider voting for him, or would Ted Cruz be an appealing nominee to you? Anna, Ted Cruz?
I have far less against Ted Cruz than I do against Trump. He's definitely more of a classic constitutional conservative. He tends to be a little bit too far to the right for me personally, and I think too far to the right for where the electorate is today, that I would prefer to see somebody a little bit more moderate.
Do you fear he couldn't win?
I do think that he possibly couldn't win in the general.
Josh?
I'm not sure about that. Ted Cruz is a very talented candidate. I think that's why he's seen such a spike in his poll numbers lately. I mean, he appeals to a lot of the same voters as Donald Trump. He captures that anger really well. But at the same time, he's got that background as being a U.S. senator and, you know, having done this before as a career. So he criticizes the Washington machine, but at the same time, he's a part of it. But he can point to his record in the Senate and say that, you know, I've even deferred from, you know, my colleagues in the Republican Senate. You know, I've really stuck to my values and stayed true to who I am. And I think a lot of voters really appreciate that. He's a very talented debater. He has been his whole life. And I think that, you know, he keeps his message fresh while staying consistent at the same time. So I think he could do very well in a general election. I'd be interested to see that.
Okay, well, Anna, you want to weigh in as well?
Yeah, I think another danger of Ted Cruz, though, is that people find him to just be generally unlikable. Right. There's a lot of hatred for him from his colleagues in the Senate, and I think that that could sort of come back to bite him if he were to go on to the general.
But evangelicals like him. And
true.
So I know
love
a lot
him.
Of Republican evangelicals, and, you know, they some of them are interested in what Trump says, but they're much more interested in Cruz. They think he talks their talk and walks their walk.
Yeah, I think he's going to fill that evangelical vote pretty easily because it is so clearly authentic with Ted Cruz. We're obviously Donald
his father's
Trump.
A pastor,
I don't think Donald Trump has been to church in a year that he went
hey, he just went the other day.
Yeah, I know.
Wanted
I know.
To read about the 2 Corinthians.
Oh, the 2 Corinthians, I like that, yeah. Yeah, I had to blame somebody else because he's not accountable for not knowing.
Right.
So, but Ted Cruz is it's hard to argue the authenticity of that.
Clearly.
I mean, I think his father's a Dominionist, I don't want to speak out of school. I don't want to. I think his father practices Dominion theology.
Okay.
I don't know if Dominionist is actually
a term.
I don't want it to be, if it's a pejorative, I don't mean to use it in that way. I think that's what his father practices. The point is, he is, I think, very authentically
going to
appeal to the evangelical vote. It will help him in Iowa. I think it's why he'll win in Iowa, even though the most recent polls show it swinging back in Trump's favor. But let's listen to what Donald Trump had to say about Ted Cruz. And, you know, these were the two guys who had this weird, we're not going to attack each other thing for a while. Cruz said he was going to bear hug Donald Trump. He's going to hug him with love. But now, gloves are off. Here's Donald Trump talking about Ted Cruz.
I don't think he's qualified to be president.
Why not?
Because I don't think he has the right temperament. I don't think he's got the right judgment.
What's wrong with this temperament?
Well, you look at the way he's dealt with the Senate, where he goes in there like a, you know, frankly, like a little bit of a maniac. You're never going to get things done that way. You can't walk into the Senate and scream and call people liars and not be able to cajole and get along with people. He'll never get anything done, and that's the problem with Ted.
Okay, there's Donald Trump talking about Ted Cruz. Here's Ted Cruz responding, talking about Donald Trump.
The concept of New York values is not that complicated to figure out. Not too many years ago, Donald did a long interview with Tim Russert. And in that interview, he explained his views on a whole host of issues that were very, very different from the views he's describing now. And his explanation, he said, look, I'm from New York. That's what we believe in New York. Those aren't Iowa values, but this is what we believe in New York. And so that was his explanation. And I guess I can frame it another way. Not a lot of conservatives come out of Manhattan. I'm just saying.
I would say to the last point, who cares about where conservatives come from? But I will say to the rest of the critique, he is not exaggerating. That is exactly what Donald Trump said, I think, in 2001 to Tim Russert. That's what he said. And Josh and Anna have been saying essentially the same thing. Yeah, Josh?
I think it's just ironic to hear Trump criticize somebody for their temperament. I mean, that's his biggest problem is, you know, voters are worried about how he would react if there's a conflict between North Korea or Iran or Russia or anything like that. So it's funny to hear that coming from Trump. But at the same time, I think it's a valid concern talking about Cruz's record in the Senate. I mean, Cruz has always been very individualistic and not always willing to go along with the party, you know, which can be good for a Senate, somebody in the legislative body. But in a president, you need to be a unifying force. You need to be able to work with the people on both sides of the aisle and get some work done. And I think Ted Cruz, in that regard, is not ready to be the president.
Okay. Anna, you are sort of reacting as well to when Donald Trump talked about temperament.
Oh, I think it's hilarious to listen to Donald Trump, of all people, call somebody a maniac. But I think that the criticisms of Cruz's criticisms of Trump are pretty warranted. You can look at his record, and I know there's a new ad that they've been running in Iowa detailing all of his positions on these issues that are important to conservative voters, you know, abortion, other sort of like social issues that they care about, that he's been flip-flopping on, to even put it mildly. So it's interesting to see that those two candidates are starting to swing at each other now when they're finding the other one to now be a threat to the winning in Iowa.
We saw speaking of weird, sort of a weird endorsement press conference from Sarah Palin for Donald Trump. Does Sarah Palin carry weight with young conservative voters that you're in touch with, Anna?
No, I can't say she does. I think she's just a pretty, she's a caricature, really. I think the Tina Fey's interpretation of her is becoming closer to reality every time you hear her come out and speak. And I'm not sure that the Palin endorsement will even help Trump that much. I think it might actually hurt him in the long run.
That's right. I think it carries some weight, but it's not good weight. I mean, a lot of people criticized John McCain for picking her to be her, his vice president's election in 2008. People just feel that she's not qualified to hold that office, and you know, making that nomination might even hurt Trump.
Before I get back to the phones, I mean, just imagine, Tim Nealon, you're John McCain watching that news conference with Sarah Palin, and you've got to remind yourself that you're the guy who put her on the ticket.
Yes, he is Victor Frankenstein. I hope you're happy with your creature. So, no, but I do think the Palin endorsement did hurt Cruz, because Cruz, she was phenomenally important in his run in Texas and was, you know, a significant supporter. And then to have her back out and support, you know, it doesn't help Trump, but I do think it hurts Cruz, because, you know, the question then is, why isn't Palin endorsing him, right? Now, again, she has a stream of consciousness that some people find appealing. You should have seen the lines to get her book signed when she was out here in
Henrietta. No, it's out there.
Henrietta.
It's real.
I mean, she's got a following here
in
Rochester.
No, I'm with you. The truth is out there.
You know, she was governor of Alaska.
For a little while.
Long enough.
Yeah, last of the term. So, no, there are certainly Sarah Palin supporters, and I think that's the evangelical crowd that could hurt Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I guess. Let's make a distinction here between fundamentalists and evangelicals, though. I think the fundamentalists in the Christian right support Sarah Palin. I'm not sure the evangelicals, okay? So fundamentalists, you know, the Bible is inerrant, infallible, you know, everything has to be taken, you know, thou shalt not wear two garments together kind of thing, versus evangelicals who have a very different reading that include, you know, experience, reason, tradition, and scripture when they relate to things. So just a shout out to my evangelical friends. We're not saying you're fundamentalists.
Okay. Herman in Brighton, next up. Go ahead, Herman.
I am not registered with either party. I tend to lean Democratic, but I have voted for Republicans when I thought they had the better qualified candidate. So you might be interested in my question here that I've been wanting to ask a Republican panel. Lindsey Graham, I think, was the best qualified candidate in the Republican on the Republican side in this race, primarily because of his foreign policy qualifications. He has sat on the Foreign Affairs Committee for a long time, and I think foreign policy is one of the most important competencies and most important duties of the president. And he couldn't get any traction. And it reminds me of what happened 4 years ago when there was one candidate who had bona fide qualifications in foreign policy. His name was John Huntsman, who had been ambassador to China and had been trade representative and so on. And he had to give up after the state in which he thought he had the best chance to win, and he put the most effort into the best he could do was come in distant third. So why is it that Republicans pass over the best qualified candidates who might attract voters like me, who are not highly ideological and who are just looking for the best qualified person? And I accuse both ends of the political spectrum of voting for whoever they think is closest to their ideology instead of the most competent person and best prepared.
Herman, do you remember a senator from Indiana named Evan Bayh, who was the son of Birch Bayh, the longtime governor there? He was sort of a centrist popular candidate who had even been talked about as running on like a fusion ticket in the past. So those are the kind of candidates that might appeal to you, yes?
Possibly, if it depends on their qualifications. I mean, like right now, there's one candidate in the whole race on either side who is highly qualified in foreign policy, and that obviously former Secretary of State. But, you know, I was leaning towards John McCain when he ran until he picked Sarah Palin as his vice president, because I thought he had good, was well qualified, and I voted voted for George H.W. Bush twice because he was clearly by far the best qualified, especially in the area of foreign policy. And that, you know, and he was not an extremist of any sort. You know, he was conservative, but he was not an ideologue. He was pretty moderate. So and same thing with John McCain. So anyway, I would like to ask this Republican panel,
sure,
as to why these highly qualified candidates who might have a chance of winning in a general election by attracting the centrist voters, the swing voters, why do they pass over them?
Herman, thanks for the phone call. Lindsey Graham first. He said he thinks Lindsey Graham was the most qualified candidate in the Republican field in his point of view, and he got no traction. Anna?
I think Lindsey Graham in particular is viewed by a lot of Republicans as being very hawkish. And I think everyone, including the Republicans, are a little wary of rushing off and sending troops all over the place. We're still feeling the pains from the Iraq war. So I think that was Lindsey Graham's weakness as far as the Republicans go.
Okay.
And you mentioned that Lindsey Graham was a centrist. That can be very helpful in a general election, but at the same time, you have to consider the primary system and how that works. So in the primaries, you hear all these, in both parties, really the candidates push to the polls, really try to sound as conservative as they can to appeal to those people who are going to be voting for them in the primaries. So Lindsey Graham really struggled to appeal to those voters.
Yeah, and Lindsey Graham's got an interesting history. I mean, he was one of these guys back when, you know, he was in the House. He was going after Bill Clinton and part of that whole impeachment process. And then later on, suddenly he reinvents himself after the kickback as a much more moderate centrist Republican. I think people who follow his career closely were probably a little dismayed by his abandoning of his conservative principles. And I think that hurt him, too. That's why he didn't attract a lot of money. And you're right, Josh. I mean, it's about who's going to vote in the primaries. These are closed. These are for members only in most states. These are closed primaries in most states. And the Supreme Court has ruled that's absolutely fine because Republicans should get to pick their Republican. Democrats should pick their Democrat. And I'm sorry that, you know, that the states don't allow independents and people who are not in the major parties to participate. But that's why you get candidates who are on the extreme. But they got to somehow, run to the right, run to the left, but then come back to the middle for the general election.
Well, and interestingly enough, we're always looking for parallels in politics, yeah. But Herman invoked John Huntsman 4 years ago. John Huntsman, if you go back and watch after New Hampshire, he gives the saddest non-victory victory speech where he says, "Tonight we won third place," and I felt so sorry for the guy because you knew it was over at that point. But Herman is invoking Huntsman comparing to Lindsey Graham. I haven't heard that. I've heard a lot of comparisons to John Kasich, the Ohio governor, who is, I think a lot of people think, more centrist. He's picked a very different posture in this primary season. He has tried to stake out New Hampshire as his last stand. He's probably not going to win New Hampshire. I could be wrong. Maybe he'll surge. Maybe a lot happens in the next 2 weeks. But that comparison has been made. John Kasich, ever appeal to you, Josh?
Absolutely. I think he's a moderate that a lot of people can get behind. He's done a very good job as the Ohio governor. I think he's just, at this point, he doesn't have the personality to, attract a lot of the people. But going back to the credentials of Lindsey Graham, I think the main theme in this Republican primary is that people want somebody who is not part of the establishment, people who are anti-Washington. Yeah. Donald Trump, Ben Carson enjoyed a lot of success for a long time. So I think in that regard, Lindsey Graham's credentials might almost be a detriment to his success.
Agreed, because they're even saying that about Hillary. Hillary keeps selling her experience in Iowa, and a lot of people are saying she should back off because you want less credentials, you want more authenticity, right? And that's the problem. When you have a history, you may change your mind, and that may look like you're flip-flopping. So that's got to be taken into account.
That's right, because honestly, Hillary Clinton is the most qualified candidate in the race. She lived in the White House for 8 years. She was a senator. She was a secretary of state.
Anna sitting next to you is had this visceral reaction to that statement.
In terms of experience, Hillary Clinton has the most, and people really don't like that. They don't like how much of a Washington insider that she is, and that might hurt her as well.
Well, they sometimes say there's a theory that, we vote for the next president we always vote for is completely different from the last one. And Hillary is probably a little bit too much like the current president of the United States in the sense that her policies are his policies. She's wrapped herself in the mantle. And then maybe that's, again, why Donald Trump looks so exciting. You said it before, Jeff. He he's definitely not Barack Obama, the careful, academically inclined president versus the man who just shoots from the lips, right? Just whatever comes into his mind.
Well, let me just read a quick email from Mary. I'm 25 years old. I would consider myself conservative. I'd be open to voting for Democrats. And Mary just goes on to say, I'm a little concerned that these primaries have shown that my party, if I consider Republicans to be my party, has moved away from basic science, things like global warming, climate change. We can at least be honest about that. Why is this seeming to be a problem? That's from Mary. She's 25 years old. Anna, Josh, she's basically saying, why is my party not even acknowledging climate science? Anna, what do you think?
I think the climate science argument just gets so overblown all the time by the left because, it, you know, if you say anything in doubt of exactly what's happening or, you know, the particulars of the science, it's you're a denier, you know. So I think that particular issue has been hard for politicians to talk about because it's been very polarized, with this last year supposedly being the warmest on record, but a lot of that having to do with like the El Nino kind of things. But, you know, people listening to this right now are probably thinking that I'm just some crazy non-scientist when in reality, I'm actually, you know, chemical engineer. I try to understand these things, but I think that's not really a fair assessment of the right just saying that we don't care about science.
Do you care about changing climate? Do you think it's a problem?
Yeah, I think it's happening, but I think the way that the government goes about dealing with it is not necessarily the right way.
Two different things. And I've come to think that, you know, people say, well, as a talk show host, you know, do you pick certain positions? I say, no, not generally, but there are certain baseline things that we have to be able to talk about. The climate is changing. It's okay to acknowledge the reality. What we do about that, there's a lot of important debate. In fact, there are some arguments that say there's not much we can do that wouldn't be economically crippling. Or at the very least, what we have to do is figure out a way to be honest about what is scalable, what's not. If we're going to change energy delivery systems, can we do it? What's the timetable? How do we do it in a way that doesn't hurt our economy? How do you get India and China and big governments around the world to get on board if we're going to be the only one? All of those are I think viable things. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand the not happening sort of thing.
Well, I will say, go look at the Wall Street Journal today. They've got a great editorial, climate snow job, Roger Pilkey Jr. and others. These are scientists, not necessarily you know, senators from Oklahoma who call it a climate science hoax. But again, I mean, you know, here's my background. I have a master's in the history of science, and we studied a lot of Foucault. So we've got a hermeneutics of suspicion when it comes to data. And so we look very carefully at the data sets, and we have changed how we measure the global. And that's why it was the hottest year. And it's about how they, you know, where they're taking the measurements. So, Mary, I think, you know, it's okay to have reasonable discussions about this on the Republican side without necessarily saying it's a hoax. But again, then you have to look at the economics. How much is it going to cost? Who's going to have to pay for that? And what will it ultimately benefit if we're developing nations continue to spew out greenhouse gases?
Yeah. Josh, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's not that Republicans don't believe in climate change or that we don't care about the environment or anything like that. It's just that we think that the economic effect of climate change policies really needs to be taken into consideration, because with all the regulations that they're trying to do, it can really have an effect on small businesses. And that's something that Republicans are being very careful about.
Well, and it's also a matter of how tractable these certain crises are. We only have so many resources that we have in order to allocate to certain things. So do we care more about, you know, if you're going to think about something like diesel fuel, better for carbon dioxide, but worse in particulate matter. You know, you should really care about something, you know, there are trade-offs for everything. So for a certain amount of resources, how much good are you going to do?
All right. Well, as we get ready to wrap up on our last 3 minutes here, let's look ahead. We start voting a week from now in Iowa, 8 days later in New Hampshire, what feels like decades later in New York State. Tim Neelan, are we ever going to change? I know. We've talked about this on the program. And yes, here's another bias the host has. I hate this primary system. And if my son's listening after school, say, Dad, don't use the word hate. I hate it. It is ridiculous that it is not rotated. And we have such little diversity in Iowa, New Hampshire, and they get so much power leading off.
There's been several schemes, bipartisan schemes, to create primaries that are regional and that they would then float every 4 years.
Yes.
So that the South could go first 1 year, maybe the North, you know, the Mid-Atlantic, 4 years after that. Anyway, so everybody would get a shot at it. And it would be one a month. so the candidates could spend a good deal of time in one region. Because the problem after New Hampshire, you know, is that candidates don't do the kind of retail politics they've done in Iowa and New Hampshire. The states get bigger, they do more air war, broadcast media, and you get less of a chance to look at them. Well, that would change. And so there's great ideas on the table. But look, you know, I've argued to change the election system in New York State to make it much more open and transparent and also easier. And that's
no
not
guys.
Going anywhere.
No
and
guys.
This is New York, supposedly, yeah. You know, we're a left of center state. And so I you know, I don't think it's going to change anytime soon.
Yeah. Don't you guys want to vote earlier in the process? I mean,
we're both obviously, well, we're from Buffalo. So being, New Yorkers, we never really feel like our primary vote counts for
and
very
you
much.
You don't see them up close. I know we're a bigger state. You would probably see less of it. But, I mean, it's just remarkable, I think, the inequity in the system. I got a minute left here. Anna, who's going to win in Iowa and New Hampshire, and who's going to win your party's nomination?
I think Cruz wins Iowa. Whoever is third in Iowa takes a little better in New Hampshire.
You're allowed to say
Rubio.
Trump will win New Hampshire.
I'm not going to say it.
You don't even want to say it.
I can't say it.
Okay.
But I think Rubio wins the nomination.
You do? You honestly think? I know you hope that. You think that.
I honestly think that.
Okay. Josh, who's going to win these next states and then the nomination?
Cruz wins Iowa. I think he's had very solid debate performances. They're generally a more conservative state, so I think he's going to take Iowa. I think Rubio's going to be very successful in New Hampshire, and he's going to take that to win the general election.
Wow. You think Rubio wins New Hampshire? I can't wait to have you back. It's going to be very interesting. And Tim Nealon, 15 seconds. We all know things can change in 24 hours before these primaries. We all think we know what's going to happen.
That's right.
A lot can change, right?
No, absolutely. So don't, you know, keep listening to this station. Listen to Evan Dawson every 12 to 2.
Do you want to make a bet on the nomination?
I don't want to make a bet on the nomination. I would say Rubio is a good choice. I think, you know, for Republicans, he works very well. So
I'm going to say I think Ted Cruz is the nominee, but I said Marco Rubio for months, and I've only moved off that recently because I don't see the path. But Josh, if you're right, if he surges in New Hampshire, everything changes. We'll see. There's a lot going on here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Tim Nealon, the chair of the Department of History and Political Science at NAS. Nice to have you here, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
And Anna Garvey, Josh Veronica. Good luck with your studies. Thanks for taking the time, and we appreciate the conversation.
Thanks so much.
They are putting their bets on Marco Rubio. Our thanks to Val LaBanca, the engineer of this broadcast. Megan Mack is the producer. Mariel Brinkerhoff, our intern today. Thanks for listening. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.